The Tolkien Road, Episode 225, The Life of J.R.R. Tolkien, Part 3. Hello everyone, welcome to The Tolkien Road, Episode 225, The Life of J.R.R. Tolkien, Part 3. On this episode, we're going to examine the period of Tolkien's life from the publication of The Hobbit through the publication of Lord of the Rings.
Sounds awesome.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, indeed. How are you, Greta?
How am I? I'm good. I'm real good. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
Okay.
All right. Now we got that out of the way.
Now that we got that out of the way, just trying to keep this banter alive until our super long theme song ends. We got to do something about this extra long theme song.
Maybe we do.
Need to do the abridged version of this theme song, I think. Methinks.
Or maybe we just need to work on our banter.
Or maybe I can just fade it out in the future. But you got to wait for that splash, the boom at the end.
I know. That's what makes it, really. Mm-hmm. That's what, you know, that's the enough of this chitta chatta. Mm-hmm. Let's get down to business. That's what that splash is all about.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Boom. Well, it is the mic drop of a sort.
It is. That's exactly what it is.
It means it's ready to, it's time to talk some Tolkien.
Talk Tolkien. Let's do it. All right. Without further ado,
let's do it. Before we get started, we'd like to give a shout out to our patrons. Special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, Elise Yu, and Andrew T. We also want to give a shout out to our newest patrons, Mike M. and Alina V. Thank you all so much for your pledge of support.
Thank you.
I also want to let everybody know that we are now able to do annual pledges through Patreon. So from time to time, we get people contacting us and saying, hey, I don't really want to do the monthly thing, but you know, I can drop you all, you know, drop you all a wad of cash, fat stack of cash one time. And now you can actually do that, but you can still be a patron, right? You can actually sign up for a whole year of being a patron. And what's cool about that is you can actually go over to patreon.com/Tolkien Road, pick the tier you want to sign up for. And then you will, if you do the annual thing instead of the monthly thing, right now you'll get 2 months free, right? You get 2 months of patronage with the Tolkien Road for free. So we're kind of cutting you a deal because this is a new thing. We're only going to be doing that for a limited time. Not sure exactly how long just yet, but at some point that 2 months free will drop down, you know, to some lower level, maybe like 1 month free or something like that. So if you want the 2 months free, that's the best deal we can give you. And so you need to go act on that now and, you know, start off 2021 the right way.
Yeah. I can't think of any right or way.
Which experts agree is becoming a patron of the Tolkien Road.
Scientific research also backs it up.
Science.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Science and experts.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
yes.
Do it.
Well, shout out to those who already annualized their pledges, by the way. These are actually existing patrons. Sarah M., Jonathan D., Chuck F., Adam, and David of Pints with Jack all annualized their pledges so far. So
thanks.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Here's the thing.
It actually, you know, it's cool for you all when you sign up because you actually save as opposed to what it would cost you to, you know, to do it for a year if it was just a monthly thing, right? But it's also good for us. It helps us and helps support us even better. It kicks the support for us into overdrive because it lets us know that you are a patron for the whole year, right? Before, all we know is that somebody signed up this month, but they might be gone next month, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just a great deal for all parties involved. It's a win-win, right?
Win-win-win.
We all love those win-wins in the world. All right. Yeah, so enough about Patreon. Also, I do want to give a shout out, though, to Clay D, who left us a nice tip via tip jar.
Thanks, Clay.
Yeah, thank you very much, Clay. Clay, a longtime listener and has corresponded with us quite a bit. So thank you very much, Clay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Lastly, last way we want to call out for support is always a subscribe, rate, and review. This is the most straightforward and easy way. If you're a listener, you should already be subscribed to us on whatever podcast app it is that you use. And then you want to rate and review us as well, especially on that iTunes whatever you can do on Spotify. I don't listen on Spotify, so but I know more and more people are using Spotify. So whatever things you can do to support us by leaving ratings and saying all kinds of awesome things about us, highly appreciated. But whatever app you happen to use for your podcast listening, please help us out over there. Subscribe, rate, and review on whatever app that is. A couple of nice reviews left for us this past week or so. The first one, let me see, let me make sure I got the right one here. Scroll up. Okay, there we go. All right, so this first one is from Robert Henry Holtz via Apple Podcasts, left on December 29th. Robert left us 5 stars and said, "Great Tolkien tribute. Really enjoy the insight and the knowledge. Fun to read along with them. This show is great. Keep it going strong in 2021.
Oh, nice.
And then on New Year's Day, 2021, Blind Macy left a review for us. Down to Middle Earth and homey is what this one says. And got to find the full version of this. I've got that saved somewhere else. Here we go. All right. This is a little bit longer. Great review, though. So Down to Middle Earth and homey. From Blind May See. "I've been a follower and patron of this podcast for a good while now. While there is no such thing as a perfect podcast, this show has a uniqueness that most others don't. They do not claim to be know-it-alls and openly accept constructive criticism. Their earlier episodes have that raw aspect due to the young nature of the podcast. It's fun to follow along as they provide higher quality content over time as well as professionalism. They are real human beings sharing the same passion for Tolkien as we all have. Sure, they may slip up from time to time with responding to emails or not have the exact same views as I do, but they are down to earth and a comfortable place to enjoy all things Tolkien. You can check out other podcasts for sure, but you most likely won't find another warm and inviting home that the Tolkien Road provides. I highly encourage everyone to give this podcast a fair chance. I started from episode 1 and still get excited for what new material is coming each week. Nothing but respect for others who put out genuine content for something they love or are passionate about. Keep up the great work, guys."
Wow.
Thank you so
really
much.
Cool.
Very nice tribute. Uh-huh. I just appreciate the, you know, how you say a lot. You obviously had a lot to say, and I appreciate, you know, that you recognize the things that are good about our podcast, mm-hmm. right? And the things that make us unique, and you appreciate that. So I appreciate your appreciation.
As do I. And I think Down to Middle Earth, I think that's clever.
I agree.
I like that little twist.
I like that we're considered down to Middle Earth and homey.
Yeah, and homey and warm and inviting.
I want this to be kind of like the Rivendell podcast, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well,
I might even, you know, call it the Rivendell podcast if I wasn't afraid of getting, like, you know, a cease and desist letter about, you know, yeah. using a word that's copyrighted as the title of the podcast. But I don't know. Actually, that brings to mind another one, but I won't say that out loud. Maybe if we ever rebrand, you know, we'll. I have another idea that maybe we would be able to pull off.
Okay.
That's still Tolkien-esque.
Okay.
But I don't know. We're not planning on that. I like the Tolkien Road.
I like Tolkien Road too.
So
rebranding sounds like a lot of work.
It is.
I think it's working for now. So
anyway, thanks.
But I'm very glad that we are viewed as a warm and inviting home.
Absolutely.
For Tolkien lovers.
Absolutely. Thank mm-hmm. you so much, Blind
yes,
Macy. That was
you.
A nice note.
Indeed.
Appreciate it.
Indeed.
Not much in the way of Tolkien news. There is still time to vote in our 2021 poll, but I think I'm going to shut it down this week. So you need to head on over to tolkienroad.com/poll21, POLL21. And that will take you to the poll where you can vote on what we're going to be doing for next year. Hmm? Or really this year right?
This coming year.
What the main focus is going to be. Again, this is not necessarily it's not necessarily guaranteeing that we're going to do exactly what, but I'm just kind of trying to hear y'all's feedback, hear where you all are, see if there's an overwhelming preference for what people want us to do, because now that we've covered Lord of the Rings, Silmarillion, The Hobbit, you know, it's kind of an interesting time for us because we're trying to figure out what's the next big thing we do, right? Mm. We've been doing a lot of this and that, and there's a lot of this and that with Tolkien to do. And we'll still continue doing some of this and that, but I think I do want to, there's other works I want to tackle that will require a longer term focus. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right. Helps us make a decision. Helps us make a good decision.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Tolkien quote of the week. So this is one from On Fairy Stories. This is from Tolkien. "Not long ago, incredible though it may seem, I heard a clerk of Oxenford declare that he welcomed the proximity of mass production robot factories and the roar of self-obstructive mechanical traffic because it brought his university into contact with real life. He may have meant that the way men were living and working in the 20th century was increasing in barbarity at an alarming rate, and that the loud demonstration of this in the streets of Oxford might serve as a warning that it is not possible to preserve for long an oasis of sanity in a desert of unreason by mere fences, without actual offensive action, practical and intellectual. I fear he did not. In any case, the expression real life in this context seems to fall short of academic standards. The notion that motor cars are more alive than, say, centaurs or dragons is curious. That they are more real than, say, horses is pathetically absurd. How real, how startlingly alive is a factory chimney compared with an elm tree? Poor, obsolete thing, insubstantial dream of an escapist. So.
Not mincing words.
I like that one. I like the continued Tolkienian obstinance on the idea that, you know, that somehow modernity is more real than, you know, than the things of the natural world or even the things of the fantastical world for that matter.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is real?
Yeah, no, getting into deep waters there.
Yeah. But that's not the topic of this episode. Just leave that last quote with you all for as food for thought. All right. Greta, let's talk about the life of Tolkien, shall we?
Yeah, let's continue.
Continue.
Let's continue talking about the life of Tolkien.
Continue, indeed. Mm-hmm. Well, when we left off, with Tolkien's life and career up to the publication of The Hobbit. I think that was back, we did two episodes on the life of Tolkien, and it kind of got up right to the edge of when The Hobbit was being started and being considered for publication. So that's where we're going to pick up this week. On this episode, we'll be looking at the publication of The Hobbit and Tolkien's epic journey to create the new Hobbit, a.k.a. Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So The Hobbit seems to have originated very early in the 1930s, perhaps even before then, as impromptu adventure tales told to his children. Eventually, he began to write them down, but as the boys grew older, he actually abandoned the story. So this is still in like the early to mid-1930s. Tolkien began telling the stories of The Hobbit, and they were kind of impromptu adventure tales that he told to his sons when they were still fairly young, right? So 1930s, like, and even maybe even starting in the late 20s, John, the eldest, would have been 12 in 1929, 13, 14, 15. So Michael and Christopher would have been a little younger than that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they liked hearing these adventure stories that Dad would tell.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where they seem, you know, the various adventures that Bilbo is involved in had their kind of seed form in these impromptu tales that Tolkien would tell. So
it didn't really start out as a cohesive story.
Apparently not. Apparently not.
Okay.
Now, it's all, I think the history of it is all a little mysterious.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
We're going to see that it's very mysterious, especially as compared to the development of The Lord of the Rings, because he started telling The Hobbit stories before anybody had any interest outside in these stories outside of his sons, right?
Mm-hmm.
This was purely just like a thing for fun, right?
Okay.
So he wasn't documenting any of it. There's not a lot of like, it's not like he sat down with the intent of writing a work. You know, he eventually got to that and started writing some of these things down, but it seems that he abandoned the manuscript before he'd had a chance to really show it to many people and have anybody seriously consider it. But apparently he showed it to enough people to where there was a little bit of word of mouth about it.
Hmm.
So it was a fateful meeting between a former student, Elaine Griffiths, and an Allen and Unwin staff member, Susan Dagnall, that gave new life to the story. So I'm going to be using a lot of references from Humphrey Carpenter's biography, which is, you know, it's the, it's kind of the authorized, I guess you could say, biography. I think that's the right term. The authorized biography. It's what it says on it. So, and it's really great. Again, I know we've recommended it before, but if you want to know the life of Tolkien, you should pick up Humphrey Carpenter's biography of J.R.R. Tolkien. It is the authorized version. So here is the story as Carpenter tells it. One of the few people to be shown the typescript of The Hobbit was a graduate named Elaine Griffiths, who had been a pupil of Tolkien's and had become a family friend. Upon his recommendation, she was engaged by the London publishers George Allen and Unwin to revise Clark Hall's translation of Beowulf, a popular undergraduate crib. One day in 1936, sometime after The Hobbit had been abandoned, A member of Allen and Unwin's staff came down to Oxford to see Elaine Griffiths about the project. This was Susan Dagnall, who had read English at Oxford at the same time as Elaine Griffiths and indeed knew her well. From her, she learnt of the existence of the unfinished but remarkable children's story that Professor Tolkien had written. Elaine Griffiths suggested that Susan Dagnall should go to Northmoor Road and try to borrow the typescript. Susan Dagnall went, met Tolkien, asked for the typescript, and was given it. She took it back to London, read it, and decided that it was certainly worthy of consideration by Allen and Unwin. But it stopped short just after the death of the dragon. She sent the typescript back to Tolkien, asking him if he would finish it, and preferably soon, so that the book could be considered for publication in the following year. Tolkien got down to work. On the 10th of August, 1936, he wrote, "The Hobbit is now nearly finished, and the publishers clamoring for it." He engaged his son Michael, who had cut his right hand badly on a school window, to help with the typing, using his left hand. The whole labor was finished by the first week in October, and the typescript was sent to Allen and Unwin's offices near the British Museum, bearing the title "The Hobbit" or "There and Back Again." So that's kind of how it came to be in Allen and Unwin's hands, and considered for publication. So it sounds like, you know, he did eventually start writing some of it down, but never finished it,
right,
and kind of put it aside maybe. And then just by chance, his former student mentioned it to an Allen and Unwin staff member, Susan Dagnall. And then that's what kind of brought it to the attention of Allen and Unwin as, you know, desires to publish it. And so some people may be familiar with, you know, Stanley Unwin and then the story of his son and, you know, writing the review of the book. After Stanley Unwin's son, Rayner, gave a favorable recommendation of the book to his father, The Hobbit was set for publication and hit the shelves on September 21st, 1937. Yeah, so that's kind of a somewhat better known part of the mythology of how The Hobbit came to be, is that Rayner, the son of Stanley, you know, little kid, his dad basically, what his mentality was, well, I'm going to give it to my son, pay him to read it and then write a report of it. And then if he likes it, then that means that probably other kids are going to like it too.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And yeah, it'll probably be a win for the company. Right.
Yeah. It's a good deal for Rayner too.
Good deal for Rayner. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he's, yeah. And it's cool for him because he's a part of the mythology. He actually,
yeah,
I think we're going to see him again a little later on because he kind of figures in as he enters the family business as he grows up. And so he actually plays a significant role in the publication of Lord of the Rings as an adult.
Okay.
So,
cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, very cool. It'd be cool to have been him
right?
for that very reason, right?
For,
I mean, how
sure
cool would that be to be like, you know, I read this before anybody knew it, and then I mm-hmm. played a part in bringing the greatest novel of all time into existence in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. That's a good legacy to leave.
Amen to that.
Yeah.
All right. And then thanks to a favorable review of the book by C.S. Lewis, the book's first printing had sold out by Christmas of that year. A second printing was ordered, and the book began to move into foreign markets, seeing its first American printing in 1938.
Oh my gosh, I like totally didn't even put that together.
What?
Like I just, like it would have been published in the UK first, duh.
Yeah.
I just automatically pictured it at Barnes & Noble. Down the street
right
from where we live. No, that's not where it started.
Yeah, not on the first printing, but it
no
didn't take long. But I thought it would be interesting for us to read this review by C.S. Lewis that first appeared in the Times Literary Supplement on the 1st of October. I'm sorry, 2nd October 1937. So, Greta, do you want to read this? Can you see, is that close enough
to
you?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
All right. So this is by C.S. Lewis?
That's correct.
Okay. So I have a quick question.
Mm-hmm.
Did it show up as, like, was it being marketed as The Hobbit or as There and Back Again or both at the beginning? Because in this review, it says The Hobbit, semicolon,
yeah,
or There and Back Again.
Yeah, The Hobbit or There and Back Again.
Because that's what it was called
yes
at the beginning.
Apparently.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, here's C.S. Lewis's review. The publishers claim that The Hobbit, though very unlike Alice, resembles it in being the work of a professor at play. A more important truth is that both belong to a very small class of books which have nothing in common, save that each admits us to a world of its own, a world that seems to have been going on long before we stumbled into it, but which, once found by the right reader, becomes indispensable to him. Its place is with Alice, Flatland, Fantasy...
I'm not sure how to say that one. Phantaste. Phantastes? I don't know.
Fantastic. It must be another book.
Yeah.
Phantastes. The Wind in the Willows.
Right.
To define the world of The Hobbit is, of course, impossible, because it is new. You cannot anticipate it before you go there, as you cannot forget it once you have gone. The author's admirable illustrations and maps of Mirkwood and Goblingate and Esgaroth give one an inkling, and so do the names of the dwarf and dragon that catch our eyes as we first ruffle the pages. But there are dwarfs, and no common recipe for children's stories will give you creatures so rooted in their own soil and history as those of Professor Tolkien, who obviously knows much more about them than he needs for this tale. Still less will the common recipe prepare us for the curious shift from the matter-of-fact beginnings of his story. Quote, "Hobbits are small people, smaller than dwarfs, and they have no beards, but very much larger than Lilliputians. To the saga-like tone of the later chapters, quote, "It is in my mind to ask what share of their inheritance you would have paid to our kindred had you found the hoard unguarded and us slain," end quote. You must read for yourself to find out how inevitable the change is and how it keeps pace with the hero's journey. Though all is marvelous, nothing is arbitrary. All the inhabitants of Wilderland seem to have the same unquestionable right to their existence as those of our own world, though the fortunate child who meets them will have no notion, and his unlearned elders not much more, of the deep sources in our blood and tradition from which they spring. For it must be understood that this is a children's book only in the sense that the first of many readings can be undertaken in the nursery. Alice is read gravely by children and with laughter by grown-ups. The Hobbit, on the other hand, will be funnier to its youngest readers, and only years later, at a 10th or a 20th reading, will they begin to realize what deft scholarship and profound reflection have gone to make everything in it so ripe, so friendly, and in its own way, so true. Prediction is dangerous, but The Hobbit may well prove a classic.
Yeah, so you think Lewis was right about that?
I think he may have been a prophet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and of course Lewis was one of those who had read the story and had, you know, was familiar with it already from, you know, just inklings and
days,
you know, Tolkien,
yeah,
reading different parts of, mm-hmm, it probably to them and, you know, to him in private settings. And of course he knows Tolkien, so he knows the
right
background, you know, of everything that goes into it, and that this is not just some, you know, some story that some person, you know, scribbled down, just thought, well, I'll put some dwarves in there and put some other stuff in there. Like, but there was like real depth and,
right,
depth of knowledge of, you know, of these like kind of ancient threads, mm-hmm, going on here.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, I just thought that was cool to read this. And because it would seem that this review had a large impact on the early success of The Hobbit, right? That, you know, it was published only a week or two after the book itself was published, and, you know, it's the Times Literary Supplement, which I believe is the London Times, so huge circulation, and so the result of that was that the initial printing had sold out by Christmas of that year, right?
I find it very interesting that the basis of this review is a compare and contrast to Alice in Wonderland. Because, mm-hmm, was it just because that was a really popular book at the same time? Is that why?
Yeah, I mean, I assume so.
It's just weird because I never thought of these two books kind of. I mean, I know they're both kind of fantasy,
right?
But I never thought of them kind of in the same vein. I feel like they're very different in a lot of ways. So it just surprised me that that's kind of what he was comparing it to.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah. Well.
2 cents.
Yeah, I think it was probably the most readily at hand work to compare it to, because, okay, it was, you know, kind of Alice in Wonderland is, yet now it seems very strange to compare the two to us, you know, because they do seem like very different works, and they really are very different works. But, you know, back then it's like, well, they're both fantasies that are kind of geared towards children, or that children will be able to enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm,
you know, or more like, you know, these kind of weird fairy tales. So, you know, that would be maybe a natural comparison.
Yeah, so. I can see that.
It's a good way to help your buddy out, right? If I comparing it to a very popular and well-known, you know, children's classic and saying that this stands up next to it, right?
Right. So. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely right. Had Lewis published any of the Narnia books at this point? Or why was he well known?
I don't think Narnia came out. I don't think the first Narnia book came out until 1945.
But he had put out other books.
Yeah, let's see here.
I'm just wondering, like, what, because clearly this review, like you said, really helped the sales of The mm-hmm. Hobbit. So I'm wondering what made Lewis a big name at this point in time, I guess, is what I'm wondering.
Let's see here. So
this is like mid-30s we're talking about.
David Bates is just shaking his
head
right now.
I know, he is.
Like, come on,
sorry,
guys.
David.
You guys should know this off the top of your head.
Yeah, I know.
We need
to have him as like our phone friend. Like, we just need to give him like a heads up, and so I can like,
David,
I'm gonna be texting you random questions.
David,
at this
stand
hour.
By. Stand by. C.S. Lewis might come up on this episode. What was he known for at this time? Because the Narnia Chronicles had definitely not come out.
Okay.
He might have just been kind of known from. Let me pull up his bibliography here. Okay, here we go. So, yeah, the Narnia Chronicles didn't actually appear until 1950.
Mm-hmm.
The Pilgrim's Regress was 1933. The Space Trilogy came out. The first one out of the Silent Planet came out in 1938. Let's see. Let me go back and see. Because I'm not sure when, like... Okay, The Allegory of Love came out in 1936. So, I'm not sure if C.S. Lewis was, like, necessarily, like, a huge name just yet, but I think he was well-known in, like, literary circles,
okay.
And just academic circles
sense.
As well. Remember, C.S. Lewis, like, Tolkien, C.S. Lewis was, like, a big personality, mm-hmm. right? Like, he walks into a room and, like, everybody, like, gravitates towards everybody. Everybody gravitates towards him, listens to what he has to say. He's, like, kind of a booming presence. So Lewis, I think, was just kind of known somewhat on that level, especially in academic circles and literary circles. But then you have Tolkien.
Mm-hmm.
And so Tolkien was like the quieter guy who Lewis is like Lewis looks to. Right?
Yeah.
You know,
they balance each other out well.
Yeah, exactly.
They were. Yeah.
And so.
They were complimentary.
Yeah. So. Good question. That was a good question. Yeah.
Thanks.
Good question.
Thanks.
And sorry, I wasn't more prepared to answer it well.
That's okay.
So,
I'm just trying to keep it real.
And sorry, David, if I butchered any of that as far as the story of C.S. Lewis. We'll accept your feedback and correction.
We will.
Gladly.
Mm-hmm.
A second printing was ordered after the first printing sold out by Christmas of that year, and the book began to move into foreign markets, seeing its first American printing in 1938. So, there you go.
I think we already said that. But it's good.
Yeah. No. I said the first printing sold out, but then I didn't get to the second part, I don't think.
No,
maybe I did.
You did, because I made the comment about how I just assumed it was printed here in America first. But it wasn't. Anyway. So, yeah.
Okay.
So the first American printing.
If you insist.
I do insist. So the first American printing was about a year later.
We checked the replay on that.
We can. Instant replay.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to challenge?
Go under
you
the
gonna
hood.
Throw your challenge flag, Johnny?
throw that red flag. Onto the desk, so you record. Yeah, what
okay.
were you gonna say?
I don't even remember.
Just causing problems.
Just throwing
a wrench in my flow.
That's how I roll. How I roll. Yeah, no, I was just it was basically a year later between the UK printing and the American printing.
Yes, well, I think it may have been early 1938.
So
remember,
a few months,
yeah,
maybe.
A few months.
Okay. Oh, yeah, because it was September of 37 mm-hmm. that it was initially printed. Okay. All right. Good.
So The Hobbit was a success.
Yes. C.S. Lewis was correct. It is indeed a classic, for sure.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Time will tell, as they say, and time has told us.
And continues to tell us.
And continues to tell us, mm-hmm. indeed. All right. So, of course... Any successful work of art inevitably leaves its fans, and especially its patrons, clamoring for another. So it wasn't long before Stanley Unwin asked Tolkien for a follow-up to The Hobbit. So, read a little bit more from Carpenter here about how that came to pass. All right, so... Unwin learned that Tolkien had a large mythological work called The Silmarillion that he now wanted to publish, though Tolkien admitted that it was not very suitable as a successor to The Adventures of Bilbo Baggins. He also said that he had several short stories for children, Mr. Bliss, Farmer Giles of Ham, and Rover Random, and there was an unfinished novel called The Lost Road. Unwin asked Tolkien to send all of these manuscripts to his office in Museum Street. They were sent, and they were read. The children's stories were all enjoyed, but none of them was about hobbits, and Stanley Unwin was certain that this was what the people who had enjoyed the first book wanted. As for The Lost Road, it was obviously unsuitable for a juvenile audience, but The Silmarillion presented a more complex problem. So, the bottom line in all of this is he didn't have any more hobbit stories, right? Everybody wanted hobbit stories because the book's called The Hobbit. Nobody thought of it. Nobody calls it There and Back Again anymore, even though that's a cool name, right? Everybody calls it The Hobbit even to this day, and I'm sure they were back then. And everybody knew hobbits, right? The hobbits are the thing that makes the book most accessible to people who are new to the world, and he didn't have any more hobbit stories. So
yeah,
he wanted The Silmarillion. The Silmarillion was the closest thing to his heart. He wanted that to be published, but
didn't have any hobbits.
Have any hobbits. He knew it was going to be, you know, a hard sell to make that happen.
Mm.
So it seems that in late 1937, he had been inspired to start a new story about hobbits. And so he called this new story The New Hobbit. Creative.
It's logical.
Right.
Yeah, it's logical. Can I ask something real quick?
Mm-hmm.
Did he ever finish that book, The Long Road, or what was it called?
No, I don't believe he did. Okay. It's actually The Lost Road.
The Lost Road.
The Lost Road is actually part of the History of Middle Earth series.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, so okay. Eventually we'll talk about that. So
okay.
But yeah, it seems that in 1937 he started this new story about hobbits. So I mean, you know, it's just a few months really after The Hobbit itself is published that he starts kind of concocting a new story about hobbits. And but The New Hobbit proceeded in fits and starts. In fact, by 1939, the story still had a long way to go from its final form, but he had settled on the title Lord of the Rings and had made the definitive decision that another hobbit, not Bilbo, was to be the story's chief protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. There's actually, and also in the History of Middle-earth, you can see the development of the story over time. And the original name, for example, of Frodo was Bingo. Right? Bingo Baggins, right? And there's, you know, it's really funny. Like, it's really fun to see, like, the development of the different names and that sort of thing. I think with one thing I did mention with The Hobbit, the original name of Gandalf, get ready for this, original name of Gandalf,
mm-hmm.
Bladorthin. I think that's right. That's either Gandalf or Smaug. I think it was Bladorthin though. Yeah.
How can you mix those two up?
Well, I'm just saying. Oh, and Strider was originally Trotter.
Trotter.
Yeah. So I think he was smart to improve on these names. I think Frodo is a step up from Bingo. I think Gandalf is definitely a step up from Bladorthin, and
mm-hmm.
And Strider is a step up from
Trotter.
Yeah.
I would hardly agree.
Now we're going to have that one listener named Bladorthin who was just getting ready to like leave us the biggest donation ever, and he's going to be like, forget you guys.
Never mind. Psych.
Psych.
Yeah.
All right. Also in 1939, Tolkien delivered the lecture on fairy stories at the University of St. Andrews. Understanding now that it was composed and delivered in the early stages of composing Lord of the Rings, one can see that Tolkien is almost delivering a manifesto on what he intends to do with his Hobbit sequel. It is not enough to write a fantastical story geared towards children. Tolkien aims to create something that is both fantastical and has the semblance of actual reality and history.
Mm.
So Tolkien has been reflecting some on his first big success with The Hobbit, and he realizes, you know, I started to change this as we got deeper into the story, but it starts off in kind of this somewhat childish way. And is that really what I want to do with my book, with this new book, right? So it's interesting to read on fairy stories kind of in that context of he's early on in composing Lord of the Rings,
mm-hmm.
but he's starting to wake up to like what he's dissatisfied with about The Hobbit. right? And what he wants to change in The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty pivotal moment, you know, that he was, that he, they asked him to give this lecture and gave him time to kind of think about his own theory of fantasy, if you will.
His whole philosophy. And it's interesting how, the timing of that and how that lecture, you know, changed possibly in a very big way what, you know, his trajectory,
mm-hmm.
which resulted in what we now know as Lord of the Rings. It could have been very different had he not given that lecture at that time.
Absolutely. There's so much, it's really interesting to couch the history of a great book and the life of its writer, because you can just see how there's like kind of these fateful turns with the timing of certain events that helped Lord of the Rings become Lord of the Rings, right? Lord of the Rings, and we'll get to this on the next episode, but Lord of the Rings was published in 1954, 17 years after The Hobbit, right?
I didn't realize it had that was that long of a span.
It's kind of crazy that anybody even took Tolkien serious, like that the publishers even took him seriously enough at that point,
right?
To want to publish it again.
So was there anything that came out between The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings that he wrote?
No major works. I mean, he had other things that came out, like short stories, and like Leif by Niggle was released, and some other, you know, some other minor works, Lord of the Rings did not come out until 1954. But also in 1939, of course, you have maybe the most significant event of the 20th century, World War II breaks out,
mm-hmm.
right? So as tensions escalate and war eventually breaks out in 1939, Tolkien faces new challenges to completing his magnum opus. Additionally, his sons Michael and Christopher both serve in the military during the war. Through the first half of the decade, he continues to make progress in fits and starts, receiving helpful feedback from C.S. Lewis and Charles Williams, as well as his sons. But still, it takes him until 1949, almost 12 years since beginning the book, to complete the first draft.
Wow.
Right? So 12 years to complete the first draft. Now, I think you can certainly excuse some of that because there was a war going on.
Yes, I agree.
And you know, there were probably just long stretches of time where he was worried sick about his sons,
mm-hmm.
and it was hard to get any work done. And this is already for somebody who suffers from, is kind of a chronic procrastinator, which I understand very well. That's a lot of procrastination at the same time.
It is, but also,
I just think to myself, if I had some huge success, The Hobbit wasn't necessarily like the kind of success. I don't think it like made him a household name,
mm-hmm.
per se,
mm-hmm.
but it was a big enough success to where I feel like if I wrote something that had like that big a success, I would want to be like, got to follow it up quick.
Yeah.
Right.
You want to capitalize on that.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah. I can only imagine Edith being there like, come on,
right.
Come on, really? You're not, it's still not done. You're not done.
Like, come on, like cracking the whip.
Yeah, right? I can only imagine. But that also speaks to, and as we well know at this point, just Tolkien's attention to detail,
mm-hmm.
and how deep everything runs. I mean, that's a lot. There's a lot of thought and time that's required to make sure that everything fit together the way it was supposed to.
Yeah. Well, that's a great point, and that gets to this next quote I want to read from Carpenter's biography, which is about Tolkien's perfectionism. One cause of the difficulty was his perfectionism. Not content with writing a large and complex book, he felt he must ensure that every single detail fitted satisfactorily into the total pattern. Geography, chronology, and nomenclature all had to be entirely consistent. He had been given some assistance with the geography, for his son Christopher helped him by drawing an elaborate map of the terrain covered by the story. Tolkien himself had been making rough sketch maps since beginning work on the book. He once said, "If you're going to have a complicated story, you must work to a map. Otherwise, you'll never make a map of it afterwards." But the map in itself was not enough, and he made endless calculations of time and distance, drawing up elaborate charts concerning events in the story, showing dates, the days of the week, the hours, and sometimes even the directions of the wind and the phase of the moon.
The direction of the wind?
Yeah.
Wow.
This was This was partly his habitual insistence on perfection, partly sheer reveling in the fun of subcreation, but most of all a concern to provide a totally convincing picture. Long afterwards, he said, I wanted people simply to get inside this story and take it, in a sense, as actual history. Name-making also involved much of his attention, as was inevitable, for the invented languages from which the names were constructed were both the mainspring of his mythology and in themselves a central activity of his intellect. Once again, the Elvish languages Quenya and Sindarin, now more sophisticated than they had been when he began the Silmarillion 25 years earlier, played a principal role in name-making, and were used in the composition of Elvish poems and songs. The story also called for the invention of at least the rudiments of several other languages, and all this took time and energy. Moreover, he had reached a point where the story divided into several independent and in themselves complicated chains of events, and while he believed that it would only take him 2 or 3 chapters to get Frodo and Sam Gamgee to Mordor, he could not yet face unraveling the complexities of the simultaneous events in Gondor and Rohan. It had taken him nearly 6 years to bring the story this far. How could he ever find the time and energy to finish it, let alone to complete and revise the Silmarillion, which still clamored for attention? He was 51, tired, and fearful that in the end he would achieve nothing. He had already gained a reputation for almost indefinite procrastination in his philological work, and this sometimes amused him, though it was often saddening to him. But as to never finishing his mythology, that was a dreadful and numbing thought.
Hmm.
So, yeah, that's, you know, he's just, his the idiosyncrasies of his personality, his perfectionism. I mean, they gave us the book that we have, right? This incredible work, but it was a painful labor for him, you know, mm-hmm. to bring it to reality. But at the same time, I think it was enjoyable too, right? It was painful.
I'm sure it was cathartic in a way. But yeah, I mean, I can see when you put that much of yourself into something and when you struggle with something as long as he did, I mean, it's a part of you, mm-hmm. you know, and knowing what a perfectionist he was, that just complicates the whole matter, you know?
Yeah, well, and
it was a very ambitious, project.
Well, and it's almost like as he wrote it, it was like, this is not ambitious enough. Like he kept on pushing himself to make it more ambitious. Right?
Yeah, yeah. He just couldn't leave well enough alone.
Right.
You know, and I can relate to that. I can.
And you also think of, it was either 1939 or 1941 that he had the dream where he woke up and just was inspired to write Leaf by Niggle. And
that just poured out of him, didn't it?
It did, but it's also a reflection. He looked back on it as a story, almost like something that popped up in him as a manifestation of his anxiety about Lord of the Rings and the Silmarillion,
that's
about his mythology
right.
overall,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right.
I guess it was the most allegorical thing he ever wrote, because here's this thing that starts as this little leaf and branches out of this big tree in this big countryside, and then, you know, Niggle never finishes it, right? In his life, right?
His fear,
right?
Clearly.
And so that's like 1941. Right at the latest that he wrote that, and he had to wait 13 years to actually see this thing come to life. All right. So what was the first assessment of the complete draft for Lord of the Rings? Well, we'll go back to Lewis again. So Lewis gave this Tolkien gave a copy of the typescript to C.S. Lewis in 1949, and Lewis. So this is before it was actually published. So this is not after the final version, but it's close to the final, you know, much closer to the final version than it had been. Lewis replied, "My dear Tollers, Utan Herion Hobbit Loss indeed. I have drained the rich cup and satisfied a long thirst. Once it really gets underway, this steady upward slope of grandeur and terror, not unrelieved by green dells, without which it would indeed be intolerable, is almost unequaled in the whole range of narrative art known to me. In two virtues I think it excels. Sheer subcreation, Bombadil, Barrow-wights, elves, ents, as if from inexhaustible resources and construction. Also in gravitas. No romance can repel the charge of escapism with such confidence. If it errs, it errs in precisely the opposite direction. All victories of hope deferred and the merciless piling up of odds against the heroes are near to being too painful. And the long coda after the catastrophe, whether you intend it or no, has the effect of reminding us that victory is as transitory as conflict, that, as Byron says, there's no sterner moralist than pleasure, and so leaving a final impression of profound melancholy. Of course, this is not the whole story. There are many passages I could wish you had written otherwise or omitted altogether. If I include none of my adverse criticisms in this letter, that is because you have heard and rejected most of them already. Rejected is perhaps too mild a word for your reaction on at least one occasion. And even if all my objections were just, which is of course unlikely, the faults I find could only delay and impair appreciation. The substantial splendor of the tale can carry them all. Ubi plura nitent in carmine non ego paucis offendi maculis. I'm not really sure what that means because I don't know Latin very well. But he finishes, I congratulate you. All the long years you have spent on it are justified. Yours, Jack Lewis. So
I'd say that's a pretty great response.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that just kind of speaks to how like most Tolkien fans feel about Lord of the Rings. It's like, you can find problems with it,
mm-hmm.
but like, it's just so good. Like, why would you want to spend any time like worrying and like argue, like criticizing it? Right.
Right. Right.
Like it's so just delectable.
Yeah, and those criticisms are really there are no huge gaping errors.
Yeah.
I mean, the criticisms, I feel like, yeah, they're there. I mean, they're there in every book.
Mm-hmm.
But in this one, I think they're pretty nitpicky.
Well, and a lot of times I think so much effort and so much thought was put into it that it's one of those things where you think you're like, oh, I found something. And then Tolkien would have been like, no, you didn't. That's actually in there intentionally.
Right.
Right.
I meant to do that.
And then he explained what part it has. And you're like, oh, awesome.
You're like, all right, you win.
Right.
You win.
Yeah. And so Tolkien told Stanley Unwin, Carpenter says, Tolkien himself did not think it was flawless, but he told Stanley Unwin, it is written in my lifeblood, such as that is, thick or thin, and I can do no other.
Mm-hmm. So, that says to me no regrets, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because I was wondering about that. I was wondering, with Tolkien being as such a perfectionist, if he was happy
mm-hmm.
with the final product. And as a perfectionist, you know, like you said, it's never going to be perfect, mm-hmm. right? But that quote to me says that he was happy with it.
Yeah.
He's like, I can't do any better, right? This is it. This is my life blood.
Right.
You know? And I love that. I love that he doesn't, you know, he wasn't unrealistic about the fact that there were flaws and, you know, all the things. But regardless of that, he was happy with it. And he felt good about it.
You just gotta leave it all in the field. You know,
you do.
It's like this is by the time he finished it, 1949, the first draft, the completed draft, he would have been almost 60 years old, right? In his late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at that point, you're just like, well, this is going to be probably my life's work, right? This mm-hmm. is going to be the culmination of it. It's really now or never. And I just love that that's his attitude towards it. Like that,
yeah,
I put everything about what I love and what I value into this, and
mm-hmm.
and I gave it everything I had. I didn't let anybody convince me to cheapen it or to mm-hmm. lower the quality of what I thought it should be. And mm-hmm. and it's that to me, that's just heroic in and of itself from an artistic perspective. That you know, he could have probably just knocked off another quick story about Bilbo,
yeah,
in 1939, yeah. and cashed in.
Mm-hmm.
But his perfectionism and maybe even in some his procrastination paid off, right,
yeah.
in the long run.
Well, he set the bar very high for himself,
yeah,
for sure. And I love that he feels like he met the challenge,
yeah.
You know, that he was happy with what he ended up with.
Indeed.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's it for this episode. On the next episode, we will discuss the final part of Tolkien's life from the publication of Lord of the Rings until his death. It's particularly interesting. I think I enjoyed, because I've already done some research for that one, I enjoyed learning about how Tolkien actually became like kind of the household name, right? Like, because it wasn't immediate, even after Lord of the Rings was published, but it was really interesting how that actually happened. And Carpenter has a good discussion of that in his book.
Okay, so, cool.
Yeah, all right, well, let's do a little correspondence. So we've been wanting to do our correspondence feedback on the Project Northmoor episode we did. So we have a couple of notes to read from that. So the first one is from Hope from December 14th. Let me find that. Here we go. All right. So Hope says, I enjoyed your Project Northmoor episode. I gave thinking the organization was creating a museum, and they never refuted that until very, very recently. Now I feel a bit conned. I'm okay with supporting a Tolkien writing center, but the project needs to have a solid plan and not keep changing direction. It just feels very rushed. I don't care that my donation is returned, only that if the house is not procured, that it goes to another Tolkien venture. On the note of the Tolkien Society, they are snobs. Tell us how you really feel. You don't have to have a PhD to be a prominent Tolkien fan. I'm also okay with not having the Tolkien Society as part of Project Northmoor because they seem to think they control the Tolkien world, and I think it is dangerous that they have so much control over most Tolkien groups, magazines, opinions, etc. The best way to preserve Tolkien is to let his legacy be divided among many different people. Thank you for another great episode, Hope. Well, thank you for your note,
yeah,
Hope. You sound very pessimistic about the Tolkien Society. I know we had some criticisms on our episode.
We did.
I think there's probably a wide range of reviews, and I can certainly understand where you're coming from on that. Every year I say to myself, you know, maybe this year should be the year I join the Tolkien Society. Maybe I'll just do it this year. I totally understand where Hope is coming from too. I think that it's just true in general that whenever any one particular group or organization starts to have too much of a say on a particular topic, it becomes very frustrating. Like, you're always going to put off a significant group of people who care about that topic as well, right? And the
mission can become kind of myopic,
yeah,
too. Because there's lots of people out there that love Tolkien, but, you know, want to express that in a way that's different than they maybe would like, you know?
Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
No, you're good. You're good. Well, let's move on to, thank you, Hope. Let's move on
yes,
to another...
Thank you.
Note, this one is from Sarah M. Here we go. Yeah. Sarah says, $6 million is a lot of money to entrust to people with a 2-page business plan.
Word.
This is true. Also, I'm still not sure who has the credentials on the team to promote Tolkien's life and faith. I know there's one researcher involved, but essentially we're donating money to buy a property that's already protected so these people can run a B&B creative writing center, which we would have to pay to stay at and attend. Yeah,
that's true.
I think you do a good job of kind of summarizing the concern of the Tolkien Society and maybe some of the maybe some other folks who look on this with a lot of skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
I just like your first line a lot, Sarah. Yeah, $6 million is a lot of money to entrust to people with a 2-page business plan.
Enough said.
It is. Yeah, you're gonna need to flesh that out a little bit for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you give me just a little more information, please?
All right. Thanks, Sarah. And then our last note is from Marilyn, the librarian. As always, Marilyn's note is a little more on the epic side. So let's dive into that one. Make sure I got the right one here. All right. Hello, Carswells. Hello, Marilyn, the librarian.
Hello.
It was a good episode on Project Northmoor. I appreciate that you were open about your opinions as opinions. Bias is not necessarily a bad thing, provided we own it up front. We all have it, and as long as we are honest and open about it, it's fine. Indeed, I think it was the lack of openness that concerned me most about the project. Truthful but misleading statements such as, there's no Tolkien museum in existence, implying that this would be a Tolkien museum and help us save the house when it isn't under any threat, are worrisome. Not to mention being silent on the fact that the only people who would get inside would be guests paying for the B&B or attenders paying to take a course or program. They stated that they wanted to appreciate Tolkien's legacy, but I don't see how they were doing that beyond the fact that it's Tolkien's house they are seeking to purchase. Certainly their goal of a house for religious retreats and writing seminars is fine and admirable, but I find it disingenuous to be using his name to attract attention as a fundraising tool if they are not primarily interested in presenting and promoting Tolkien and his work to the wider public. Yeah, I think that's the Marilyn, that's a great point. I think that's the thing that I would like to see most of all about this, is if it does come to fruition, that it's going to be all about Tolkien. Right?
Yeah.
Like, it just needs to be, like, even as a writing center, I don't know, like, that's, like, to me, that should be, like, almost a secondary purpose if it's even going to be part of it. It should be, you know, if Tolkien is the main thing, then it needs to be, like, I like the idea of a Tolkien museum.
I do, too. Yeah, I do, too.
So, maybe they need to do something more like that. I don't know. I do encourage you to join the Tolkien Society. They're a wonderful, hardworking, and fun-loving bunch. You should see the pub quizzes and the costume ball and the art gallery and the poetry readings and the dead orc gatherings after the annual Zoom Oxenmoot is officially over, who value scholars and fans alike and are deeply dedicated to their mission of bringing Tolkien's works to the world. As a registered charity, it is incumbent on them to be open and welcoming to all, and so they must remain neutral with respect to religion of any kind. Particularly important is a country with an official state religion, Anglicanism. It may even be a requirement for their UK charity status. I don't know. At the same time, they discuss religion and Tolkien's life and works quite freely, and while they choose not to be involved in religion as a society, many of the members are active Christians, as well as multiple other religious identities. The Guardian is one of the major UK newspapers, not unlike the New York Times, so they use a journalistic standard for facts and must maintain neutrality on religious matters. The religious orientation of Project Northmoor is a fact, and The Guardian was the first place I read about that. From my reading of it, there was no value judgment attached to that reporting, but obviously, YYMV, I just looked that up too, and I don't know, but what's that? It's a, oh, your mileage may vary. Your mileage may vary. That's what it is. So I guess it should be YMMV. Let's see here. YYMV. Yeah, your mileage may vary. So, okay. Yeah, maybe it should be YMMV. Anyway, as to why anyone who owned the house would want to sell it, I know what you mean. But I also know that owning a famous and or historical house can be a great burden. Often there are restrictions on what you can do with the building, how you can decorate it, etc. And how many people a day do you suppose there are who stand outside it taking pictures, as I did 2 years ago? It's in a beautiful residential neighborhood and has a very high hedge, but the blue plaque is still there for all to see high up on the front of the building. I have to imagine it attracts a lot of attention from fans, walking tours, and others. You're standing on someone's property.
That thought just popped into my head,
too. Y'all might know that we are huge fans of the television show Breaking Bad, and when we were in Albuquerque, New Mexico a few years ago, we absolutely stopped by the Walter White House.
You know we did.
And got yelled at by the lady who lives there. Bless her heart.
Even though we were like a good block away.
We were. There's a big fence around it now. And we did not throw a pizza on the roof.
We didn't.
People have done that. And they should. That's really like, that's. Maybe it was funny the first time, but it's never funny again. And you deserve to be arrested for doing that. Somebody lives there. Anyway, it's a tough world. I totally get that, Marilyn. It's tough when you. It's probably tough to be the owner of a house like that, especially if you live there and have to deal with people who probably want to get the cooler picture, you know, than everybody else, and be like, "This is where, you know, get up real close to the window and be like, this is where Tolkien, you know, wrote most of The Hobbit. Like, let's climb up on the roof and see if we can get a picture into the attic, right? You know, or something like that.
Yeah,
right?
That would be annoying. Yes. That would be annoying for sure.
So,
but I also kind of wonder, like. Like, I mean, if you just stay in your house, you wouldn't even know that they were doing that.
Yeah, but not all of the people who are interested are simply doing things like what Marilyn did or like we did, which is where we just kind of want to see it and get a picture in front
That's
of it.
That's true. Some people are a little bit more obnoxious about
it. Oh, absolutely. Well, like I said, there's a famous scene in Breaking Bad where Walter White is so mad and he hilariously tosses a pizza up onto the roof of his house. And people have literally gone to that house and thrown pizzas on the roof because they want to create that scene, which would be very annoying if someone was doing
annoying.
That to your home.
Yeah.
And
it's
really
also a waste of pizza.
It's a waste of pizza, and it's technically a crime. It's an act of vandalism.
It's
right?
an act of vandalism. So, yeah, it's true. But now she has a very high fence, like with barbed wire on
well,
it.
But then you've also got to deal with neighbors, right? Like That's your neighbors true. Are like, come on, you know?
Yeah, then it gets on the neighbors' nerves too, I'm sure. Yeah, yeah. And especially, and then you add on to that with Tolkien's house being a historical. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of, yeah, there's restrictions on, you know, you can't really make it your own. So I can understand. I can understand maybe now a little bit more why someone would want to sell it. But it sounds like Marilyn shares a lot of our same concerns when it comes to Project Northmoor.
Yeah, well, in all of our feedback, it tells me there's a diversity of opinions on this topic of Project Northmoor and, but also a diversity of opinions on the Tolkien Society. Mm-hmm. I'm overall optimistic about both Project Northmoor and the Tolkien Society.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, it's always good for good organizations to get good constructive criticism and maybe even hear a little bluntly what people think about them. And, you know, and hopefully they can pivot on that and do better stuff. I know we've tried to do that over the years with this podcast. And, you know, even when we do get criticism that's very blunt and negative, you know, try to listen to it and say, is this just a troll or is this somebody mm-hmm. who's...
Can it be constructive in
some
way?
Is this something that we can take home and make the podcast even better if we listen to it? So,
yeah. I'm very intrigued by the Dead Orcs gatherings. That sounds very cool to me.
Yeah. That's interesting. Maybe Marilyn will write and tell us a little bit more about what that's all about.
Yeah, the Tolkien Society, like, I'm just...
Maybe that's like... I picture that as like really intense cosplay where people dress up in like crazy orc outfits like of like, you know, like... Because orcs already like would have a lot of like cool makeup and that kind mm-hmm. of thing. And like mm-hmm. costumes, but then maybe the dead version is like zombie orcs or something like that.
I was gonna say maybe like zombie orcs.
Yeah,
yeah, that would be cool. Maybe you should join.
Yeah,
the Tolkien Society.
Well,
it sounds like it might be fun.
I don't really have a reason. I haven't. Other than just procrastination.
I just assumed I wasn't smart enough to join them.
Because
or well read enough.
Because it has the words with society.
Exactly. Yes, I really do. So, like, it'd be one thing if it was like the Tolkien peeps or something like that. You know,
the Tolks crew.
The Tolks crew. Yes. Yeah. See, I'd fit right in with
you said that.
That
kind of a Cockney accent.
But like, but the Tolkien Society.
Yes.
You know, I'm like, I don't own a ball gown, so I probably can't join.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe we could. Maybe. Anyway, I really always do appreciate Marilyn's comments. She really makes me think about things in a different light all the time. And I really appreciate that.
Great stuff.
Yeah.
And, as well as the both the other notes we had on Project Northmoor as well, the feedback we received on that. So
for sure.
Always love hearing the diversity of opinions on such topics.
Always. Yes.
All right. Well, we'd love to hear from you about whatever's on your mind with regard to Tolkien or the podcast. Mm-hmm. TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com, website, TolkienRoad.com, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, etc. Maybe one of these days, Instagram.
I feel like we've been saying that for at least a year now.
I'm so bad at the socials. Every time I go onto the socials and I'm like, I'm going to do more on social, you know, starting now, I go on and I'm just like, it social media just sucks my will to live. It really does. Like, I'm not a social media person.
I'm not on it at all.
I'm not a social person in the first place, right? I'm not a very, like, we need to go just find reasons to hang out with people all the time. You know, as you well know, Greta, sometimes people come along and they're like, let's do stuff spontaneously. And I'm like, but I'm working on something, mm-hmm. right? I'm much more of like Tolkien in that way, I guess you could say. So
yeah, I think that's probably fair to say.
So yeah, the social media sucks my will to live, but but sometimes it's fun when it's not sucking my will to live.
Yeah, and if yes, there is a way to use it in a healthy way, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, well, whatever. All right.
Okay. I think we need to be done.
We're done.
We need to finish.
End of the episode. Thanks to everybody who watched, everybody who listened, especially to our patrons. Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien.
Lise U.
Andrew T.
Shannon S.
Brian O.
Emilio P.
Zeke F.
James A.
James L.
Chris L.
Chuck F.
Azia V.
Ish of the Hammer.
Teresa C.
David of Pints with Jack.
Jonathan D.
Eric S.
Joey S.
Eric B.
Matt L.
Johanna T.
Ms. Anonymous.
Sam N.
And Mike M.
As well as to all of our other patrons. And especially to those celebrating their patron anniversary this month and last month. Tyler W.
Shannon S.
Brian O.
Margaret L.
Emilio P.
Zeke F.
And Katie W.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you all so much.
Yes.
And we will talk at you next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye, everybody.